Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
People with mental health conditions such as schizophrenia or major depression or bipolar disorder are dying, you know, on average up to 15 to 20 years earlier than people in the general population who don't have those conditions.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi. Today's guest is Dr. Brendan Stubbs. He's head of physiotherapy at the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust and a clinical lecturer at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, King's College London. Brendan's research focuses on physical activity and mental health and the mind-body interface. Brendan and his team have published over 400 academic papers, and in 2016 he was identified in the journal Nature, which is sort of like one of the biggest journals you can imagine, almost like the Oscars of all journals, as one of the most productive scientists across all disciplines in the world. He's published a book called Exercise-Based Interventions for Mental Illness. I'll put the link to that in the show notes. I highly recommend you get it, particularly if you're a health professional. And the links to all the academic papers that we talk about are referenced in the show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com. And don't forget, my new book, Eat to Beat Illness, is out now on Amazon and in all good bookstores, where I talk about the principles of healthy eating and I apply these to how it can improve our brain, skin function, heart health, stress, amongst other medical specialties. And I introduce Lifestyle 360, which is a journey through what additional activities can complement your health and well-being. Plus, obviously, there are over 80 new delicious recipes that you can try right now in your kitchen. Go out and get it. The link to it is in the show notes. But now, on to the podcast. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy for you to get. And I think, honestly, I was looking at your bio a couple of days ago, and you're probably the most published person that I've had on the show thus far. Literally hundreds of papers.
Well, it's all a result of teamwork. I've got some fantastic colleagues that I work with locally and also internationally who've been really supportive and encouraging in terms of helping us develop the evidence base. So really the reflection of the number of publications is just as a result of working with wonderful collaborate and collegiate colleagues.
Yeah, and talking of collegiate colleagues, you've written a book, Evidence-Based Interventions for Mental Illness, that you've kindly given me today. I'm very touched by this, by the way.
It's a pleasure.
Honestly, this is an incredible resource. I was looking through it. I was going to get it this week as well, and you pulled up with it today for today's recordings. But it's so vast. You've essentially, well, I'll let you describe, actually. You've done this with Simon Rosenbaum, right?
Yeah, so this is a book I've co-edited with Simon Rosenbaum, and he's an exercise physiologist in Sydney. And essentially we've been on a journey, which we'll go through over the course of the podcast, really trying to get to the nuts and bolts of the evidence of physical activity to promote mental health and also to be used as a strategy to manage various mental health conditions. So we've done lots and lots of research and published academic papers, but really not many people, even clinicians or the general public, are not going to have time to read 20, 30, 40 or more papers. So what we wanted to do is work with many other experts to condense the evidence base into practical tips for personal trainers, allied health professions, doctors, nurses, or anyone interested in the area to say, within all of these different mental health conditions, what are these mental health conditions? Why may exercise be useful for this mental health condition? What does the actual evidence say? Because it's important that we build this on evidence. Mm. And what can we do to implement the evidence for exercise in these individual conditions? And we brought it together all in a book.
Yeah, and talking about all the individual conditions, you've ticked off so many of them. I mean, we're ranging from everything from depression to anxiety, schizophrenia, alcohol issues, addiction, eating disorders. I mean, this is like my psychiatry placement in a book here, but all to do with exercise. It's so exciting.
Absolutely. We're really pleased to have it going out so people can have access to it and pull it up off the shelf and say, what can I do for this particular person? And really give people an additional option, because, you know, currently within psychiatry, it's really important part is medication, and that's really important for people's journey. Also, psychological therapy is really, really important. But also give people that added arm that exercise can be a really important adjunctive or complementary treatment for people with lots of different mental health conditions, as is sort of evidenced by the underpinning science.
Yeah, and you've done so much research. It's not all to do with mental health, actually. I was looking through some of your publications, and it spans everything from, I think you looked at cannabis and suicide, you looked at osteoarthritis, and inflammation, inflammatory diets. Like, it's just, like you said, it's teamwork, definitely. But that's a very, very impressive, mate.
Thank you. It really is the result of teamwork and forming good collaborations with people. But my main sort of real interests are looking at physical activity for the promotion of mental health. Because most of what we talk about, although it's changing recently, has been how physical activity and exercise can make us look different or physically change us. But I'm really interested in how it makes us feel different and how it may help prevent the onset of mental health conditions or be used as a treatment. Mm. The other sort of main arm of the research that I'm really interested in is how the mind and the body connect together.
Interesting.
And how the body can affect the mind and the risk of mental health conditions and vice versa. And the other arm is really sort of healthy aging and trajectories and what influences how we age over the course of the lifespan. And I suppose a cross-cutting theme of the research which we've done to date is looking at something called meta-research. And that's looking at all of the research that's been published on a particular area to try and give us more definitive answers. I'm sure perhaps we've all read a newspaper story about a particular exercise or a particular drug. One week it works, the next week it doesn't, the next week it does. And it gets very confusing. And what meta-research does is look at all of the published data, has a look how good is the research, and brings it together to try and come up with a more definitive and overall answer to say, does a particular intervention work? So we use those particular techniques to answer lots of research questions.
Yeah, and we've noticed that actually. You pointed me in the direction of something you recently had published, I think it was in February 2019, about the effects of dietary improvement on the symptoms of depression and anxiety. And it was like a huge, huge study looking at 45,000 patients?
45,000 people, yeah. So again, massive teamwork. Yeah. And we work with some really, really renowned experts on that particular project. So Professor Felice Jacka is a co-senior author on that, and she did the SMILES study,
which
is absolutely fantastic. So that's the first randomized controlled trial looking at a nutritional Mediterranean style dietary intervention to try and improve depressive symptoms in people with major depressive disorder. So we worked with her and other people to look at all of the evidence base to say what happens when you try and improve people's diet and you compare it to control conditions or treatment as usual. And do you get changes in people's symptoms of depression? So we included people with depressive symptoms and also major depression. And what we found is really exciting and encouraging is that you can get improvements in depressive symptoms when you have improvements in people's diet, particularly following a Mediterranean-style diet. We found some really interesting results within the subgroup analyses. So interestingly, we found that there were beneficial effects in females but not males. We're not quite sure why that is. And another really interesting finding from that is that studies which also focus a nutritional intervention on weight loss also had larger effect sizes in reducing people's depressive symptoms.
Interesting.
And we know that depression and overweight and obesity are commonly comorbid or can affect each other.
Mm.
So that's very interesting and also very exciting that in addition to usual care, trying to improve your diet and focusing particularly on the Mediterranean or a natural style diet, you can get improvement in symptoms.
Yeah. Is there a way of teasing out whether it was overall like BMI or waist to hip ratio or whether there was any assessment of the visceral fat and if that was more associated with depressive symptoms or depression?
We couldn't go down into that granular detail, but it was just changes in body mass index.
Gotcha,
so
yeah.
We don't know if it was changes in visceral fat or changes in muscular tissue.
Mm.
But it's really interesting.
Yeah, are there any hypotheses as to why we see a greater effect with women in these sorts of...
No, we're not sure. We're not sure particularly why that is. And the field's really emerging and exciting. So this has been all looking at trials, so interventions. But there's been some observational data where we'd look at people over time and look at how their diet may influence the risk of developing depression. And what has been demonstrated, again, with meta-analyses of observational data, is that people who eat a more traditional Western diet, so, you know, higher in sugars and more refined carbs and saturated fats, are more likely to go on to develop depression compared to people who eat a less inflammatory diet. So the inflammatory hypothesis is one of the mechanisms through which may increase the risk of developing depression. But also the Mediterranean-style diet is also quite anti-inflammatory, so that may be one of the mechanisms which reduces the depressive symptoms for people with depressive symptoms and major depression. So that's really exciting.
Yeah.
And I know that there's you know quite a robust evidence shown that when you look at people with major depressive disorder and you compare them to controls and you look at these peripheral inflammatory markers, cytokines and chemokines such as interleukin 246, C-reactive protein, tumour necrosis factor, you consistently find there is this elevated peripheral inflammation in people with major depression also. And we did a meta-analysis last year looking at all of the data, about 80 studies, and found there were consistent increase in all these inflammatory cytokines. And if you bring it back to the antidepressant literature and you look at what happens when people improve on antidepressants, you notice this decrease in some of these peripheral inflammatory cytokines as well. And we did a paper on that in neuromolecular biology as well. So that could be one of the mechanisms through which diet reduces people's symptoms of depression.
I have so many questions about this.
Sorry, that was a bit of a waffle.
No, cool. That's absolutely fine. Because I'm fascinated by this theory of inflammation almost underpinning a lot of different chronic lifestyle-related diseases that we're seeing in the Western world, or creeping up into developing countries as well as they adopt a more Western diet or Western lifestyles as well. There was a book I'm sure you come across by Professor Edward Balmore that's talking about the inflamed mind, and I absolutely love the perspective on that and how we've had a dualistic theory of thinking about mind and body as separate, and now we're actually becoming more receptive to the idea of inflammation actually affecting the brain, which was previously thought to be immunoprivileged. Also, the inflammation component and how that is directly related to or causal for depression. Are we getting any closer to a biomarker that could essentially, that we as frontline practitioners could use in the diagnosis of mental health issues, particularly depression, and medications as well? Or lifestyle changes, as I'm sure we'll talk about with exercise.
Yeah, sure. I don't think we're at that stage yet. Most of the evidence around inflammatory changes is cross-sectional, and there is some prospective data, so I don't think we're particularly at that stage yet. But as you know, many of these inflammatory changes also occur as a result of many other factors as well. So it's quite difficult to disentangle, is there a causal pathway?
Mm.
There has been some really nice Mendelian randomization studies, and this is a really fancy genetic type of study where you look at causal pathways between an exposure, say in this instance, an inflammatory cytokine and chemokine, and an outcome, in this instance, depression. And there is suggestion that some of these inflammatory cytokines, particularly C-reactive protein, may be causally associated with higher depressive symptoms and major depression.
Yeah, so I think like what I find fascinating is we can measure a lot of these different chemokines, like IL-6 interleukins and all the different TNF-alpha in laboratory sessions, but we can't do that in frontline medicine at the moment to essentially give people an understanding of what may be related to their symptoms.
Yeah, quite. And it's, you know, some of those tests, as you know, are particularly expensive and you can't be routinely going around taking people's TNF or C-reactive protein as well.
Yeah.
So hopefully some of the evidence, which we'll go over the course of this, talking about lifestyle being a marker as people's well-being and also risk of depressive symptoms could be a good indicator.
Yeah, because looking at like some of the patients that I see on a day-to-day basis, I can understand where they're getting inflammation from, whether it be another condition that they're suffering alongside depression, and that's causing an inflammatory output, whether it's their social situation, whether it's lack of movement and sedentariness, which we know is associated with higher levels of inflammation. It's quite amazing, like, you know, that we haven't developed something, or something's not on the horizon, to essentially test that hypothesis that I form in my sort of clinic when I'm looking at someone and how we can actually treat them using lifestyle or other sort of pharmacological therapies.
Yeah, hopefully that will be a good next stage, and then we could ultimately develop personalised interventions on the front line for people based on their presentation. I think that'd be amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly if we could go down the non-pharmacological route and looking at lifestyle as an approach for those particular people.
Yeah, so we were connected by Romy, who's a good friend of mine, who's a psychiatrist, training psychiatrist, and she connected us an email. I was like, you guys definitely need to speak to each other. I'm fascinated into what you were chatting to the trainees about, because I reckon they were completely blind to the idea of exercise being therapeutic and all the other and the science based behind this, because this isn't a natural part of their training, right?
No, absolutely not. As you know, and you've championed, lifestyle medicine has not been routine part of general medical training full stop, but particularly within psychiatry it's adopted very much this dualistic treatment approach where medication or psychotherapy is the frontline treatment approach for people, and there's really good evidence base for both of those approaches in a range of mental health conditions as well, and clearly it's important. So very much I'm a person of invitation. I was kindly invited to go and talk to the psychiatry higher trainees about the evidence base for exercise and various mental health conditions. And
where
I just
start.
well, we're very concerned in mental health services, particularly at the moment, around the scandal of premature mortality, where people with mental health conditions such as schizophrenia or major depression or bipolar disorder are dying, you know, on average up to 15 to 20 years earlier than people in the general population who don't have those conditions. And 70% plus of those early deaths are attributed due to non-communicable diseases, physical healthcare conditions, particularly cardiovascular and metabolic diseases. So this is a, you know, it's a human rights disgrace, really, that this is happening to this portion of society. So what I'll often do is when I'm talking to medical doctors or psychiatry trainees is I'll put up some of the hardcore evidence looking at physical activity and exercise as an actual treatment for cardiovascular disease and also preventing mortality. There's a particular paper within the BMJ in 2013 which I love to put up, and it was a paper by Nacy and Professor Ioannidis, who's the, you know, the awesome professor at Stanford University. And essentially what they did was this head-to-head comparison in the general population of huge numbers, compared physical activity versus common pharmacological interventions for cardiovascular disease mortality, such as statins, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and various medication classes. And essentially what they found for cardiovascular mortality is exercise and physical activity was broadly as effective as these common pharmacological interventions. So it often it's a very good weighty study to put up. Obviously, medics like the BMJ, it's commonly read, it's got a lot of kudos with it, so I often use that as a particular hook to get people interested. Oh, I could keep going on and on and on about the evidence base.
You mentioned two different things there, physical activity and exercise. Is there a distinction between those two in the literature, and how do we define what is exercise and what is physical activity?
There is. So there's a really famous definition from the 1980s, which, and essentially physical activity is defined as any bodily movement that increases energy expenditure. So that literally is any bodily movement. So that could be just going to pick your hand up, pick up a cup of tea, going to do the washing, going up and down the stairs, just general moving. And that's really important for all of us. But exercise is a subset of physical activity where you have a specific intention to improve your fitness. Mm. And often exercise is a higher intensity than physical activity, although physical activity can be vigorous. And when we're talking about physical activity and exercise, we talk about how difficult it is based on the energy expenditure. So we talk about light physical activity, which is typically lower levels of activity, such as very light walking or doing some housework or chores. And then we have moderate physical activity, which could also be classified as exercise, and that could be brisk walking, where you're getting slightly short of breath when you're doing something, or having a gentle jog, or perhaps playing badminton at a not very high level. And then we have vigorous physical activity, which is at the other end, where you're really panting to get your breath when you're doing a particular exercise. It could be sprinting or doing something else quite vigorous. So that is a distinction between physical activity and exercise and the different categories of it. And most guidelines, such as the government guidelines here, or also international guidelines, have really focused on trying to get people to do more moderate and vigorous physical activity. So currently here it is recommended that you do 150 minutes of moderate physical activity over the course of the week, or 75 minutes of vigorous. It could be in chunks over the course of a week. And we've really neglected the importance of light physical activity as well, that incidental sort of light walking, just moving around, because there's really good evidence for physical and also mental health benefits, that this is also important for a range of different outcomes as well.
Absolutely. I remember from my psychiatry rotations when I was training as a general practitioner, and actually when I was a junior doctor as well, I was rotating in psychiatry. It seems like the healthcare professionals in psychiatry are not as aware as they perhaps should be about the different issues that we were talking about. They're causing health inequalities, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and how they can better prep themselves and actually inspire their patients to do better and actually improve their sort of outcomes. Has that changed now? Because I remember on the mental health wards when I was working in Brighton, there was a dedicated smoking room to help essentially allow the patients to, you know, still smoke, and because it was thought of, well, allow them to do it, because otherwise it can worsen psychiatric outcomes. What's your opinion on that, and does that still happen?
So things have massively changed. So when I first came on mental health wards, it was in 2003, and people would say, what the heck have we got a physiotherapist on a mental health ward for in that particular time? And times have changed and improved.
Yeah.
And at that time we had smoking wards, and if someone was going to be taken out for a walk, it would be very much, let's go out for a walk and a smoke.
Yeah.
And some of the staff would smoke with the patients as well. Thankfully, particularly around smoking, perhaps before we more get into the lifestyle, things have changed massively. So my own trust, to South London and Maudsley, went smoke-free a couple of years ago. And they did lots of consultations with people using services and also staff. And there was a lot of anxiety, particularly from healthcare staff, that there was going to be major issues and patients were going to get very violent and aggressive. But some colleagues published a paper in The Lancet Psychiatry. It was a time series analysis looking at all of the incidents of aggression for all of the time before the smoking ban and all of the time afterwards. And what they actually found, once the smoking ban was implemented over this 2-year period, was violence reduced significantly by about 30% compared to the earlier part. And one of the hypotheses particularly related to that is that if you're not able to smoke on the ward and you're continuing to sort of facilitate smoking breaks, you're continually taking people in and out of sort of nicotine withdrawal. So people are getting more anxious and agitated. So that could be one of the mechanisms. But also it frees up staff time to do more meaningful activities, perhaps, you know, taking people out for a walk or doing something more therapeutic as well.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it, actually. I never really thought about it, because I remember that sticking in my head as a lowly sort of GP trainee, trying to figure out, like, why are we not promoting smoking cessation? Obviously, it becomes very obvious to a healthcare worker as to why we wouldn't have done that. But now looking at the data, that doesn't seem, it didn't seem extinctive. It didn't seem that something that would improve violent episodes.
Yeah, it's an amazing result. I mean, you'd have hoped for at least, really, at the data that it wouldn't have had any change, but to actually see a reduction is quite remarkable. and it's looking across big data and big numbers. Mm. So it's believable real life data of what actually happened. And another one of the misconceptions around smoking cessation for people with mental health conditions is that, you know, people are not interested in wanting to quit smoking or not able to, and are not offered help to stop smoking. But there's really robust data from randomized controlled trials, which is very good evidence showing that people can stop smoking. And going back to some of the points I made earlier about people dying, you know, like 20 years earlier with these common mental health conditions, you know, it's absolutely tragic. So we must do everything we can to improve the lifestyle for these particular people as well. And it's a frightening statistic from the United States, again, nationally representative data showing that one in every third cigarette is smoked by someone with a mental health condition.
Oh, wow.
So it just goes to show how common it is. In mental health conditions.
And I think that really is a good way of describing just how much health inequality there is with those suffering with mental health conditions, particularly those with severe mental health issues, schizophrenia, depression, severe depression, because I think it's the last thing that we think of when we're looking at a patient. Like, well, first let's treat the psychiatric issue because that seems to be most pressing, and then we'll think about the other issues that can potentially improve their lifestyle and the risk of other lifestyle-related diseases. I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. We have to look at them more as a general patient that we're trying to improve a whole bunch of outcomes of, because that does have an impact on their mental health issues, right?
Absolutely. And what I would really like to do as a piece of research going forwards is when people first come into services, particularly young people, is if at that point of crisis, obviously we can help stabilise people's mental health, but at that time we really get in a robust evidence-based lifestyle intervention package then to support them to, you know, improve their focus on their diet and also increase their physical activity, and having some of those interventions which can really improve their mental health and physical health. Because some of the medications which are often used, and again, I'm not going to knock the medications because they do work and they're really important for people, like all medications have unwanted side effects, but some of the most common side effects are weight gain and also increased risk of other cardiometabolic issues and diabetes. Yeah. So if at that particular moment we can also really throw the kitchen sink at people to do this non-stigmatizing intervention of exercise and you know, lifestyle, could be a real opportunity to prevent some of the downstream issues of the weight gain and the low moods that may come as a result of it.
What sort of ways and methods have you introduced to the psychiatry trainees, with regards to improving their ability to motivate their patients to increase physical activity and maybe even do structured exercise?
So it's been relatively simple pieces of advice. Yeah. Equipping people very much with the knowledge about the evidence base has been an important first part to get people on side. But then it's been very much reinforcing the message that just encouraging people to do small changes can make a really important difference. Many people with long-term mental health conditions, particularly if they've been in services for a while, are inactive and not doing much, but it carries a lot of kudos if their sort of leading doctor or their doctor makes recommendations about being more active.
Absolutely.
So just having those encouraging conversations can be really, really important. So I just reinforce that message that just getting off the bus a stop earlier, or just, you know, going for a walk on your lunch break, or just once a day, just doing 5 minutes, and that can be really, really important to get changes in people's mental health and physical health. And once people become more active, then they can move along that physical activity continuum and increase the intensity and the amount in which they can do. Yeah. So it's really empowering people with the knowledge and also the sort of support to be able to do that.
We talked a little bit about the mechanism by which physical activity and exercise can improve mental health outcomes, it being an anti-inflammatory, essentially. That's comparable to some of the drugs, actually, from some of the research that I've seen. Are there any other hypotheses or actually mechanistic reasons as to why we see improvements in mental health across the spectrum, as is evidenced in your book, for mental health issues?
So there's a number of different hypotheses which we're working on at the moment. The anti-inflammatory hypothesis is a common one. Mm. We're still learning in the field. But one of the other areas which is really exciting is looking at the area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is responsible for, you know, our feelings and consolidating memories from the short to the longer term. And if we look in lots of different mental health conditions such as depression or schizophrenia or even some cognitive issues such as mild cognitive impairment, we see a decrease in volume in the hippocampus. Mm. But this area is also really responsive to aerobic and potentially resistance exercise as well. So there's some. We did a paper in NeuroImage published in 2018 looking at all of the interventions for aerobic exercise over 12 to 16 weeks. And do we get changes in the hippocampus across clinical and non-clinical populations? And we found that over this relatively short period of time, you can get improvements in hippocampal volume.
Increases in hippocampal volume,
wow. Which is really, really powerful. But there was a really, really nice study conducted earlier this year, and the first author's gone from me at the moment, but it was conducted in Japan. And it wasn't actually in people with a mental health condition. But what they did do was they randomised these people in their early 20s to light physical activity, where they just did some very, very gentle cycling, and the other group just sat still. And they did a functional magnetic resonance imaging scan, so they're having a live picture of what's happening within people's brains. And after just 10 minutes of light physical activity, this really important area of the brain for how we feel and also our memories, and which has decreased in many mental health conditions, they found there was this rapid firing up in terms of connectivity within the hippocampus and increase in blood flow. So although we've shown over 12 to 16 week you can get improvements in the volume, just doing 10 minutes you can get real life, real time changes in this essential emotion processing area of the brain as well, and from light physical activity as well. So
that's incredible. Are there particular mental health conditions that respond better to those, or even mild increases in physical activity compared to others?
So most of the evidence to date has been looking at anxiety and stress disorders, and also major depression and schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And if you look in, say, depression, for instance, there's really good evidence now that from randomised control trials, so we're comparing it to no intervention, and we can causally say is the treatment that's making an improvement in outcomes, you can get improvements in people's depressive symptoms, which is absolutely incredible. So we've got really convincing evidence that exercise, aerobic and also resistance exercise, can reduce people's symptoms. And the NICE guidelines, which guide clinical care in the UK and carry a lot of clout, are going to be changed later this year. And very much in line with the evidence around the treatment of depression, there's going to be a recommendation that as a frontline treatment for mild to moderate depression, exercise is offered as a frontline treatment, which is really exciting.
That's
to
brilliant.
See that recognition.
Is that going to be alongside treatment therapy or as a first step?
Either. So wow. it could be a first step recommendation or alongside treatment.
Yeah, I can imagine it almost being a package, like going along to park run or walking groups, or like a whole bunch of other activities that are available to the locality of a general practitioner. I find that there's a lot of variance up and down the country as to what is actually available to patients, and it also depends on how enthusiastic the doctor is about the evidence base, or if they're even aware as well.
Absolutely. And the individual sort of knowledge and confidence as a clinician to make recommendations has such a powerful impact on whether you're likely to pass that information on to your colleague. And I find that when I talk to healthcare professionals or medical doctors, that there is a real increased sort of thirst for knowledge, but some of the evidence is still not being filtered, particularly on the ground floor. Of course, you get some really interested and very forward thinking and colleagues who really push that, but generally, because people are so busy, it's very difficult, even if you are immersed in the area of the literature like we are, to keep on top of it all of the time.
Yeah, totally.
That's why, you know, podcasts like this are so important, to try and get the evidence out.
Yeah, we'll actually talk about tips for general practitioners and other healthcare practitioners at the end of the podcast, just to sort of give people an understanding of like how and why this is so important to bring up with everyone, I think, in a preventative manner as well as in a therapeutic manner. We talked a little bit about the anti-inflammatory effect and the changes in hippocampal volume. Are there any other sort of hypotheses as to why this might actually be having benefits on mental health issues?
Yeah, so I don't want to be too reductionist about it. We're very much learning at the moment. You know, I spend quite a lot of time looking at the literature, and we don't have a definitive solution yet. And in reality, it's probably very complex and multifactorial. Yeah. There's many factors which contribute to it. So clearly there's some psychosocial mechanisms which contribute, you know, perhaps increase in confidence in your body, increased self-efficacy.
Definitely.
And just feeling better about yourself. And that's really important. That contributes to people's mental health and well-being also as well. And there's also emerging evidence around sort of the endocannabinoid system, although we're not there yet, whether we can say if that definitively contributes to protection of mental health. But one of the areas which has floated around for a very, very long time is looking at endorphins. And is it endorphins that really account for this feel-good and antidepressant effect? But we actually don't think that's a mechanism through which exercise makes people feel good. Because if you look at some of the physiological data, endorphins can't cross the blood-brain barrier very easily. So it's probably not related to endorphin release and many of these other factors.
Interesting, because that's like a commonly held belief, I think, amongst a lot of practitioners, that you exercise, you increase endorphins, it makes you, you know, feel good and happy hormones and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but the science is actually really, really shaky. There's some robust physiological data showing that endorphins have a you know, great deal of difficulty permeating the blood-brain barrier. So it's not likely to be that, but you know, unfortunately, some of these hypotheses can stay entrenched for many, many years afterwards. I mean, it's kind of like the old antidepressant sort of effect, that you address this chemical imbalance, you're depleted in serotonin, and we give you these antidepressants, and they replenish and improve your serotonin levels. And again, that's not how we believe antidepressants work.
We as human beings have a tendency to think about things in a very binary fashion, but unfortunately, our physiology just doesn't work like that. Like I'm fascinated by the number of different pathways like a single drug can impact, and almost, you know, the covariance amongst all these different factors. When you go to parkrun, for example, not only are you exercising, but like you said, you're part of a community that can again have an impact on your psychosocial factors, feeling of self-worth, feeling of community, a sense of purpose, that sorts of things. So there's so many different things that you can't really count for and factor into scientific research.
Absolutely, and we can only do our best in that. I mean, as humans, we're amazing what we do. I mean, we're incredibly complex, and we don't understand many of the underpinning mechanisms which can contribute to it. And all we can do is try and adjust in what we do in statistical models for all of these other factors. But no human research, really, particularly when you're looking at a lifestyle, is perfect. There's always going to be unmeasured factors and unknown unknowns which can contribute to it. And I suppose when you're developing interventions and you're looking at a randomized controlled trial, so theoretically speaking, the only difference if you do a robust randomized controlled trial between the people getting the intervention and the control should be your actual intervention. If you do a good randomized control trial, everything else, those psychosocial mechanisms, contact, circumstances, should, if you use big numbers, even out across both groups. But of course, it's research is imperfect. Because as people, we're so complex.
Yeah, definitely. And it's very hard to randomise certain lifestyle factors as well. And
very, very, very difficult. And you find something really interesting within the physical activity literature generally. So there's a really nice, interesting meta-analysis generally, which looked at what happens to the physical activity levels of people in control groups. So they sign up to an exercise intervention study, and then you get randomised to the exercise or the control group. So you know you're signing up to an exercise study.
Yeah.
You'd have been given an information sheet and told about the benefits of the study, why exercise is going to be good for you. And then you get assigned into the control group. And then what they find consistently is that people in the control group all of a sudden start becoming more active as well. Because they're enrolled in this study telling about the benefits of an active lifestyle. So it's very difficult to control for those
things. It is. So sort of healthy behaviours, that as soon as you heighten it in people's awareness of like, oh, okay, I might start moving a little bit more. You become a little bit more consciously aware and stuff.
Yeah.
I find it's almost one of the ways in which I like to motivate people when I see them. You know, instead of saying you should exercise 150 minutes per week, which I find for a lot of people is largely unhelpful because it sounds very... It sounds very overwhelming, I think, for a lot
fully
of
agree.
Issues. Yeah, yeah.
150 minutes is a lot, and there's been many weeks when I've not met 150 minutes of moderate physical activity. But the American guidelines recently came out at the back end of last year, and they've actually shifted the goalposts in line with some of the research. Which is demonstrating that 150 minutes should be the lower threshold, but aiming to get up to 300. Mm. But they've added a really, really important caveat to that, because recognising that so many people do not meet 150 minutes, particularly those with chronic physical or mental health conditions, and just really emphasise that if you these are aspirational targets, if you're not meeting those, just getting started and making small changes, just a couple of minutes a day, can have a real important impact on your physical and mental health as well. Mm. Because these targets are not meant to put people off from being active, because it'd be easy. I mean, many of the people that I work with would look at these and say, I'm never going to do that. I'm just not going to get started.
Absolutely.
But that is not the purpose of guidelines. So that's been reflected recently within the American guidelines as well.
Yeah, I like this concept of physical activity and improvements in that, because there's so many different movement hacks that I talk to people about, like standing desks, for example, moving around every hour, or putting a timer on your phone so you actually get away from your screen, as well as things like using the stairs, or I don't use the stairs when I use the underground, but I do walk up the escalators. Yeah. And I think that's kind of like my compromise for it.
Yeah, those small little snacks throughout the day are just so important as well.
Yeah,
just taking those small changes.
I'm fascinated by the evolutionary advantage of or disadvantage of having depression. Like, why does this actually happen? You know, there's so much beauty in our design, like how our cells work and how we take in macronutrients and then convert them into energy and stuff. Why does depression happen, and why do we? And I'm putting a massive question to you at the moment.
Wow, Rupi, you are.
Yeah, I'm going really deep here, but why does this happen? Why are we seeing record levels of it? And I know this is a complicated question and answer as well, because there's so many different factors that will contribute as to whether one person has depression or not. And our traditional treatment is just you give a pill for an ill, and there's one diagnosis and there's one answer. But this there has to be a reason as to why we are seeing record amounts, and what has happened, what we've done to our environment that can be contributing to it.
Sure. So let me start okay. So let me start by saying, you know, depression is extremely complex. There's a number of important genetic factors which contribute and increase people's risk of developing depression as well. So we can't ignore genetic predisposition for some people. But there's a number of important environmental risk factors which predispose people's risk of developing depression earlier. I mentioned earlier Professor John Ioannidis at Stanford University, and he has developed a particular technique to understand how good is all of the evidence on a particular topic. So if you look in the literature, for instance, at what may contribute as environmental risk factors for depression, there will be lots of meta-analyses that have looked at individual exposure, such as social status, whether relationship breaks up, whether sex makes a difference. And he's developed this method called an umbrella review, where you quantitatively reappraise all of the evidence for risk factors for a particular condition. So we worked with Professor Ioannidis and published a paper last year to look at every meta-analysis that had ever been looked at to say what are the environmental risk factors which contribute to depression. And you do a number of statistical tests, and you essentially classify the evidence into four different grades through some statistical tests. And if I go into detail, I will send everybody to sleep, but I'm happy to send people a paper. Yeah. But essentially you come up with, is the evidence convincing, highly suggestive, suggestive, or not significant? So you look for biases within the data. Is there enough cases and samples? Mm. And essentially out of 134 pooled meta-analyses, so people had pooled data 134 times from lots of different environmental exposures, we only actually found 5 environmental risk factors with convincing evidence which contributes to the risk of people developing depression.
Okay.
So those risk factors with convincing evidence were obesity, having 4 or 5 metabolic risk factors, sexual dysfunction, trauma during the childhood, and also relationship issues, if I remember correctly. So a lot of the evidence is really not up to scratch about what is actually contributing environmentally to the onset of depression. This is looking at big data population level. So that's not to say that other factors don't contribute.
Sure.
Clearly it can for individual people. So hopefully in a rather sort of long-winded way, I've emphasised that depression is complex,
yeah.
It's genetic, there are environmental risk factors which come together to increase people's risk. Getting on to your other point about why we're seeing this increase in surge and high levels of depression, again, I think it's complex, but we're much more open now as a population and as a community. We're being much more open to talk about our own mental health, and there's been some great role models within the media, people talking about struggling with their mental health. And it previously we've, you know, very much had a sort of, you know, don't sort of talk about it, you know, don't sort of disclose it. But now there's been a real shift in awareness for high profile people coming out and talking about it. And also amongst healthcare professionals as well, people are much more aware about it. So I think it's a combination of increased awareness, people's increased willingness to go and seek help, and increasing information that there are treatments that we can do to help you.
Yeah, actually, there's a colleague of mine who's on the Clinical Entrepreneurship Programme as well, and he talks very openly about mental health issues within medical staff, particularly those on the front line. He's a paediatrician, and, you know, the concept of having to deal with psychological trauma of being in an emergency scenario where you're at a cardio an arrest situation, and then you're expected just to go to work straight after that and then go to work the next day and the day after that, having had that traumatic incident. For most people in general sort of like non-medical environments, that would be harrowing and they'd have to take weeks off work. But being a medical practitioner, you need to get used to that. So there has to be some sort of way in which we allow for that sort of that normal response to a stressful scenario like that to essentially process it ourselves. And at the moment, we don't have that. And I think that's a really important point amongst medical professionals, to be very open about the fact that we do have issues, and it is we have to process them ourselves.
Of course, and you know, so important, because life can be hard for us all at certain times, and particularly when you witness difficult situations like you will do in hospital environments. I mean, generally, when people come and see us as healthcare professionals, or particularly in emergency department, things are not going particularly well.
Yeah.
For people. So it's quite obvious that we're going to see difficult situations and people in great distress. So to not be affected by that and be surrounded by that, you know, you'd be superhuman, or you wouldn't be human. Of course, it's natural that we're going to be affected by people's distress and people's loss and bereavement, and it's so important to be open and honest, and you know, have good role models who can, you know, talk openly about how they're dealing with things as well.
Absolutely, yeah. What was sort of your fascination for the field? Because you've dedicated 15 years of your clinical life to this now, and you're super published, as we mentioned. What's like your driving force for this? Why are you so fascinated with mental health?
I just find it such a fascinating area.
Yeah.
For so many reasons. I just really feel a passion for people with mental health diagnoses, and coming in as a physiotherapist with physical healthcare training, I was immediately in mental health service able to spot those inequalities and the high levels of lifestyle sort of behaviours which weren't particularly positive. And I just really came in and started to try and understand what the evidence base was for what I was trying to do as a clinician, and just sort of thought, gosh, you know, there's really not much evidence at this particular time. And I just thought, gosh, you know, maybe I should try and do something about it, and went on a long journey to trying to become better at research and contribute in that way. And And I just feel it's an enormous privilege to be part of people's lives and stories, and working with those in mental health services. So my Thursdays is a clinical day for me, and I work in a secure hospital in South London, and it's just such a privilege to be part of those people's lives and to help them on an individual basis. And a lot of the other things is the scandal of premature mortality.
Yeah.
I mean, people with severe mental illnesses are dying 20 years before people without. You know, that's an absolute disgrace, and it's largely due to preventable physical healthcare conditions we can do something about. So just trying to jump up and down and make some evidence to try and do something about it is really what drives me.
Yeah, it's very humbling to be in a position where you can help people at their most vulnerable states. And do you think... you going in as a physiotherapist and actually spending a lot more time individually with patients, even though a lot of psychiatrists actually do have the privilege of spending a lot more time with them, do you think that gave you a different perspective? And it was actually a lot more obvious to you, the health inequalities that you saw and now are trying to do something about?
Yeah, it was immediately obvious to me, because naturally, as you'd want, mental health care teams are really, really good at looking and focus on looking at people's mental health and managing their mental health symptoms. Coming into physio with a, you know, an overwhelming focus on physical health and lifestyle, I was immediately able to see some of these issues that people have in, you know, people having like pain or, you know, being really overweight, and see how I could contribute to that. And now going forwards, I think it's a real advantage, particularly with the evidence base. But I also find that because I really go and often help people's physical health, some of the patients or service users I work with, you know, really enjoy that time out from sort of the core mental health team and come and see me and perhaps go and see people in the gym and have that time to talk out of the context of sort of core mental health team, although I am part of it. But being a sort of physio, I can, you know, sort of slip under the radar a little bit and build up good rapport with patients.
Do you think their guard kind of slips down because you're spending a little bit more time? You're talking about something a little bit different outside that sort of like medical medicalization of what they're used to with the doctors and nurses and stuff.
Yeah, I do. I think it really does go down. I mean, most of my clinical work at the moment is in a secure hospital. Just also to sort of say that data has shown again and again and again from robust data that people with mental health conditions are much, much more likely to be victims than to be perpetrators or engage in any sort of crime.
Absolutely.
But some people do end up in the criminal justice system. So instead of languishing there and not having their mental health treated and being really unwell, they come into a secure hospital, and that's where the focus of my clinical work is at the moment. So many of those people I work with have been in a prison for a very long period of time, or mental health services have difficulty building up trust with people. And I often find that sort of being in a physio and looking at people's sort of muscles and bones and fitness, they really like that. You know, they don't see that I'm coming in to sort of come and assess their mental health, and I can really build up a good rapport with people, and it's just such a privilege to go in and do it.
Yeah, that's super interesting. If you could redesign, not maybe you don't want to redesign, but if you could design the perfect sort of like mental health environment for those who are in a mental health institute or in those in the community, how would you go about doing that, and where would you put perhaps a little bit more focus? I pretty much know what you're going to say, but but just for those listening at home.
So early intervention is key. So when people are presenting with their first mental health crisis, clearly they need to have their mental health assessed. In an ideal world with unlimited funds, what I would like to do at that particular time is also have like an adjacent gym or other fitness health studio, which is also has like kitchens. So immediately when people come in for their first treatment, and perhaps when they're sort of stabilized or they're well, they can come in and we can really engage people in exercise and also, you know, nutritional interventions as well. But that should be very much a follow-on, because we don't want people to stay in mental health services. We want people to get well and go out in the future. So help support people once they are stabilized to go into the community to live, you know, healthy lives longer term. That would be a sort of real dream when first comes into contact, and we can really help boost people's self-esteem and prevent some of the other issues which can arise when medication is perhaps first prescribed and people get weight gain and so on and so forth.
So I know your legacy is going to be kitchens and gyms in institutions that are helping people, A, with their acute interventions, but B, helping them, again, go back into the community and live normal, happy lives.
Absolutely. Because, you know, if you go into like a new gym or something, like even myself, if I go into like a new gym and it's busy, you know, it can be quite anxiety provoking if you don't know where the equipment is or where stuff is. So I think, you know, enabling people when they first present to have positive experiences around making lifestyle choices, but then also in buddying up with people and going into like local community and supporting them to make links and have positive first experiences would be so important for people, because we don't want people to be put off to engage. And of course, gym's not for everyone. It could be going to parkrun, it could be going for a walk, it could be trying out a local yoga class. But just really helping people make that smooth transition would be really powerful.
Yeah, and you said at the start that you're interested in mind-body interventions and stuff. Are there any particular ones that shout out to you or perhaps have a better evidence base than others?
Yeah, so quite interested in yoga. So there's good evidence around yoga as a particular mind-body intervention for various mental health conditions going forwards. There's also some evidence around Pilates can help as a mind-body intervention. But they're the main ones I'm interested in at the moment.
Yeah, I've had a colleague of mine, Dr. Claire, come in, and we're talking about yoga and the evidence base behind that. And it's quite fascinating just how many different health issues that yoga can be helpful for.
Yeah.
A lot of I practice yoga myself. I go to the odd class, but I tend to do it on my own because I don't like looking at the teacher all the time and cricking my neck and figuring out which position is the best to be doing or whether I'm doing it right at all. But that's super interesting. So
one thing I didn't mention was we about like why exercise helps with depression.
Okay.
So we did a randomized controlled trial with some colleagues in Germany, and again we looked at aerobic exercise supervised over 12 to 14 weeks, and we wanted to try and understand what are the neurobiological underpinnings of that. And we found that there was a change within this substance called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is very important to stimulate brain cell regeneration in key areas. And we found quite an exciting increase in BDNF, and that could be one of the mechanisms which is related to the antidepressant effect of exercise, and also really influential into the hippocampus.
That's really interesting, because I've read a lot about that with regards to Alzheimer's and cognitive decline, and how that might be having a positive effect on symptoms and slowing. There's nothing that really definitively reverses Alzheimer's at this point, even though there have been some anecdotes in the literature, but certainly helping with symptoms and slowing the progression of it's quite a harrowing disease.
Yeah. So the evidence around sort of exercise as an intervention for dementia is there has been some promising smaller randomized controlled trials which have been published previously showing that it may help slow the decline compared to treatment as usual. And there's been a number of pooled meta-analyses that have looked at that particular data. But there was a big study done, led out of the University of Oxford by Professor Sally Lamb, called the DAPA study. And it was published in the British Medical Journal in 2018. And essentially what they did was a real high-intensity supervised exercise intervention, a really robust, credible study, and they compared it to treatment as usual and recruited a large number of people, over 300 people with dementia from memory.
Wow.
And they actually found that exercise didn't have a beneficial impact on people's cognition. So because this is a particularly large trial, larger than anything that had ever been published before, we're sort of a bit more less optimistic about the potential for exercise for slowing cognitive decline. However, adding that caveat, there are many other benefits from being active for people with depression, such as working on helping people improve their mobility, preventing falls, and all of the other things as well.
Yeah, especially if you consider depression and mental health illness is actually one of the commonest causes that we see for sick days and people not returning back to work. Yeah. You know, there are so many other benefits of exercise that you want to factor in. It's not all about the parameters within a particular experiment.
Quite. We published a meta-analysis last year looking at people's physical activity levels in the general population, and we looked at over 260,000 people across the world, and we looked at how active they were and what was their risk of developing depression like in the future, on average 7.5 years later. And we found that people who were most active compared to those who were least active were around 15% less likely to develop depression in the future. That was evident when we adjusted for other factors that may contribute, such as people's body mass index, chronic conditions, people's age and sex. It was evident in children, in adults and older adults, but the most potent effect was when people met 150 minutes of moderate physical activity over the course of the week, and there was around a 30% reduced risk of developing depression in the future. And that was evident across all geographical continents, so we're looking at population data here. Now, this is observational data, so we're just observing people over time, and we can look at the direction, because people are free from depression at baseline, and we're looking at follow-up, do they get depression? But it's still observational data, and we can't make causal inferences from observational data. But there's very, very recently, within the last month, been a very exciting study, again, a Mendelian randomization study, which is a real fancy genetic type study looking at gene-environment interactions, to say, is there a causal pathway between physical activity and major depression? And essentially, they found in over 300,000 people, there is a causal pathway between being more active and protecting against the emergence of depression. But also, there's a number of small randomized control trials which have also backed this up. So there's been two randomized control trials where instead of the intervention being something helpful, like let's give people a drug or give people exercise, the intervention for people in their early 20s with no mental or physical health condition was sit still, do not move, be more sedentary, and the control group carried on as usual. And what they found is this enforced sedentary behaviour in these healthy young, you know, people in their
20s. They made them sit down.
They made them sit down. That was the intervention. They enforced sedentary behaviour.
Wow.
And what they found was over a four-week period, those in the intervention group who became more sedentary started to have low mood and become depressed.
Wow.
So we've got the observational data from our meta-analysis showing an increased risk of depression from being inactive. We've got this genetic Mendelian randomization data now showing there is a causal pathway. And we've got some randomized control trial data showing if you enforce sedentary behavior, there is a causal pathway. And one of the studies published in a British Journal of Psychiatry looked at the mechanisms for that, and they found it was related to changes into interleukin 6
right.
as well. So that's probably one of the mechanisms,
yeah.
Which goes again to the inflammatory hypothesis. I don't want to be too sort of reductionist about it.
Of
again,
course,
there's
yeah.
many other factors which contribute.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show at a population level just how important being active can help us to maintain our positive mental health.
Wow, what an episode with Dr. Brendan Stubbs. He really is an absolute fountain of knowledge. He was sat across me without any notes and just pouring out study after study just at the top of his head. He really is an incredible academic and a clinician, and I'm so excited that he is pioneering the research looking at exercise-based interventions for mental health illness. And coincidentally, Exercise-Based Interventions for Mental Illness is the title of his book that I highly recommend health practitioners in particular get. One thing to reiterate from our conversation with Brendan, and it's something that he agrees with, is that it would be naive and reductionist to think that we can reverse all of our symptoms of depression or other mental health issues with just one intervention alone, be that diet or movement or pharmaceutical. And in many cases, patients require more than a collection of foods or an exercise regime to treat something as complicated as mental health issues. So it's not simply a case of a neurochemical imbalance that needs boosting, and it's really, really important to keep sight of that, making sure that you get the right help and interventions from your doctor and other health professionals is key. And psychotherapy, as well as exercise, as well as diet, as well as pharmaceutical interventions on occasion, can all have a important role. We talked about inflammation, we talked about diets, we talked about movement and just increasing physical activity rather than just focusing on specific exercise regimes can all have benefits to our overall well-being and particular our mood. These are all topics that I talk about in my new book, Eat to Beat Illness, in the section on mood, where I talk about nutritional science but also lifestyle features that can improve and preserve our brains, our cognition, as well as our psychological well-being. The links to all the academic references are on the show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com. You can find Brendan at Brendan Stubbs on Twitter and Brendan.Stubbs on Instagram, plus the links to all his research is actually on thedoctorskitchen.com as well. He has a research gate profile that links to all of his 400 plus academic references. It is really a library of information that he's created. Make sure you give this podcast a 5-star rating if you enjoyed it. It really does help other people who can find the information useful find it. And subscribe to thedoctorskitchen.com on the website. I'm trying to put out newsletters every 2 weeks to give you top tips on how to improve your well-being. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.